This morning, we continue with our line of thinking begun last week. God is able and God is willing. He is just as willing as He is able. And so here we want to again ensure that you focus on Christ. We can profit in our trials and afflictions and our obstacles if we understand that our God never changes, no matter how greatly our circumstances do. He's always the same. His promises are true. So we understand this. We can at times be like the psalmist and wish that we could grow wings. Remember in Psalm 55:6, he said, "Oh, that I had wings like a dove, then I would fly away and be at rest." And we have a lesson to, again, grasp with an illustration out of the book of Jonah by way of introduction today. And the lesson is this. Relocation is not usually the answer to our problems. Our misery most likely has its roots within. Case in point. You are all familiar enough, I do believe, with the book of Jonah and the prophet Jonah, and was given a task from God directly that he would go to Nineveh. You all know that. He didn't want to go to Nineveh. He had a problem with that. He was miserable over that. And so what he decided to do was relocate. Rather than obeying God and going directly to the site, to the field, he embarked on a sea voyage to escape. He went down into the hold. And I want you to understand this, that whenever God's people, whenever they are in the midst of a contrary situation, seek simply to patch a solution on by relocating to a different spot, whether it's physically or whether it's mentally, it generally does not avail anything until you get to the root within. And so God had, as a result of that, sent a storm in the location of Jonah's ship. Point being that whenever you and I misread or ignore God's commands to do what He wants, we usually wind up involving other people unnecessarily. And because of Jonah's contrary attitude to the will of God, he put the lives of sailors on board that ship in great jeopardy. And yet we find, even in all of that, that whenever they did finally confront Jonah and found out he was a prophet of God and that he was really not to be where he was, we find again another lesson of man's futility in trying to remedy by their own means, by the energy of the flesh, to bring about a solution. And the scriptures in Jonah say that the sailors rowed hard. Jonah's remedy was, look, throw me overboard. They wouldn't do it. They rowed hard. Human futility to remedy the disobedience to God's will. So God placed upon that ship and its sailors a storm due to the ill-advised action on the part of the prophet Jonah. That's just a point of illustration. Relocation is not usually the answer to our misery. Likely it has its roots within. We also would have you remember something, and we're going to speak to this because we're going to go from ship to ship this morning. And keep in mind, again, your focus. God is as willing as He is able to deliver us in the storm or out of the storm. Either way, He can deliver us in it or He can take us out of it. We would all prefer which course of action, however, on the part of God. I'd rather be removed out of it. And so what we do here at Grace Baptist Church and our sister churches like us, we look around us, we see the storm clouds howling, and we probably are praying for the Lord's return, like probably with an urgency that we've never done before. It seems like the words of an old Bible college professor, Rembert Carter, are very, very much prophetic. He said way back in the mid-70s to his class of budding theologians in Baptist foundations, he says, what the church needs today, 1975, is a good old persecution. And if you find in, if you look into the scripture, you will find that when people are under the pressure of external sources outside their control, they begin to look upward with a little more frequency and sincerity. So we would rather, if we had the choice, be delivered out of, but he may just as well deliver us within. Now that's not to say, prophetically speaking, that God has plans for the church to go through the 7-year tribulation period. That's not on the table. That's not even a possibility. Though some good and godly brothers would disagree with me, they're free to do that. And as I always say with great humility, they're free to be wrong. So we proceed this morning on this particular count today. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers them out of us all, out of them all. We get delivered out of them all, one way or the other way. We also would have this by way of review, that we need, as Bible-believing, God-trusting people, to settle upon a resolve, and that being that we would be willing to let God prepare the winds of our adversity. Whether we have our wish granted and we fly away like the psalmist, or whether we wing our flight over the ocean depths, let us resolve for God to be the one who prepares the winds of adversity. And just as there was a whale's belly in the ocean with Jonah's name on it, so there will be a safe place for you to land, although the environment may not be agreeable to you any more than it was to the whale, if I can say that. So our focus in the church is on him. He is able. He is able. Last week we looked at an assortment of verses. We, I think, began at Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, proceeded to Acts 20, 32. Those verses, if you will remember, if you took notes or margin notes. In Matthew 10, 28, we found that he is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. So who should we fear? We don't fear man. He can only take care of one, but we ought fear God. We ought to reverence God, who is able and has indeed the issues of life and death in his hand. In the book of Acts chapter 20, verse 32, we read that he is able to build you up, that he is. In Romans 4, verse 21, he is able to perform his promises. And that in Romans 4, 21, if you remember in the context, was the Old Testament narrative of Abraham and Sarah. Two old folks, well beyond the reasonable childbearing age, even in their time, were promised a son of promise, and God was true to his word. He delivered the son of promise. We also understand that with the passage in the book of Jeremiah whereby Israel finally and ultimately disobeyed God with regard to their treatment of the Sabbaths and other things and their idolatry, that they have been in exile for some period of time. For that reason, many today in the Christian community and the political community believe that Israel has no right to their land, and that they must and should give up their land for peace. There are many prominent Bible-believing theologians who do not see Israel with land blessings. Many of godly theologians today mix Israel with the church, and they don't see a distinction between either one, and so they tend to blend the truths together. And they're wrong, of course. But we understand that Israel is in a state of unbelief at this point, and yet in Romans chapter 11, 23, we read last week that he is able to graft them in. His plan is again to bring Israel into trusting, believing obedience in the land. The King himself, the Lord Jesus, will one day rule and reign on a literal throne, bodily rule on a literal throne in Jerusalem. At least 7 years from today. At least 7 years, I say. We also looked at 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 8, where we read there, He is able to make all grace abound to you. He's able to do that. And again, in the surrounding context, has great meaning and great pleasure in just simple reading. We also noted that in Ephesians 3 and verse 20, He is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. All that we ask or think. Now, I might also say to you as we proceed forward, and here I would like you to look with me, please, at a couple more references on His ability. And then I'm going to direct your attention back to the book of Acts for our lesson proper today, which basically is this. Our lesson for this morning that will originate or derive out of the book of Acts, chapter 27, is this. Staying focused, seek the frapping. Staying focused, seek the frapping out of Acts 27. We'll arrive there momentarily. First place I want you to see in the scriptures, as we continue on our theme, is out of Philippians chapter 3 and verse 21. If somebody would please arrive at that place and then be so kind as to read it for me, please. I would be greatly appreciated.
This shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto His glorious body, according to the working whereby He is able.
He is what, what?
He is able.
Say it again. He is what?
He is able.
To do what? How many things?
All
things. Okay. Can I just point out one thing out of this reference, Philippians 3:21? God is fashion conscious. God is fashion conscious. And may I also say that God is interested in high quality fashion. High quality fashion. He is able to subdue all things. For example, fashion our bodies like His. He's fashion conscious. High quality. Now, just a couple of subnotes underneath that. At 1 Corinthians 15, verse 49. Have somebody arrive there, please. 1 Corinthians 15, 49. Let's look at this high quality fashion. Okay. We would read it in the very same fashion. We shall bear the image of the heavenly. That's high fashion. That's high quality fashion. We shall bear the image of the heavenlies. And then in 1 John 3 verse 2, we shall be like Him. High quality fashion. High quality fashion. Second place I want you to go to is 2 Timothy 1 verse 12. Something else He's able to do there. 2 Timothy 1 12. Okay, all right. The convincing is based upon the ability that God has to keep that which we have committed to Him. He is able. Now, just what is it that you have committed to Him? What is it that you have committed to Him? And if you have this, where then does fear have place? What have you committed to Him? Huh? Yeah, everything. Say that. Okay. All right. When God said, like for example, in John 3:16, God so loved the world that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. Okay. And having believed, and having then been forgiven, having then been imputed righteousness, having been declared righteous, having been placed into the body of Christ, having been saved from sin, not in your sin, but saved from your sin, you've committed unto him the keeping of your soul, body, soul, spirit. And he is able to keep that. Now, do you believe that? Well, do you? All right. Now, if that be true, and it is, then what issue could possibly arise by way of trial, affliction, or obstacle, or storm, or whatever, that could rise to the level that would threaten God's veracity to keep his promise? Is there anything? Some of you guys are on the clock yet. You still punch a clock and you go to work. Some of us also in the room are drawing the well-deserved blessing of many years on the job, and you have pensions. And what I say would you do? Even the very thought of this would probably gag us all, should, or nauseate us. What would happen if you wake up tomorrow morning and you look at the TV news, whether on the TV or online, and you find that Greece has come to America? And all the money that you have due and all the funds and resources you have counted on to make it from day to day to day, to pay all your bills, provide your health care, provide your food, put gasoline in your tank, buy your clothes, buy your makeup and your foo-foo and all the rest of the stuff, was no longer available to you. Boy, did God blow it, didn't he? So with that, you're being overly melodramatic, Pastor, a little bit off over the edge. No, I don't believe so. I pray God it never happens that way. But even if it does, we have something he said on more than one occasion, intimated implicitly and explicitly, that is worth more than all the gold. I don't want to say in Fort Knox because I don't know if there's any there. But let's say all the gold in China. Okay. And what would you say? Where would you retreat at 8:05 Monday morning upon finding that you woke up in Greece? Well, you hustle down to the bank. And you find a line wrapped clean around the block waiting to get in. And little bit by little bit, the word comes back through the line that there's a sign on the door, bank is closed indefinitely. Oh, not the fear. Reach into your wallet, you pull out your plastic, you run up to the ATM, you put the old ATM, your card in the ATM, and you're looking for cash, and you get a message up there. I guess that's how, I never used one, so I'm just speaking off the top of my head. You get a message there, bankrupt. And you get nothing. So where do you go based on what God has said? If you have committed, if he is able to keep that which you've committed unto him unto the day of redemption, where do you go in the word now to rely that all earthly props or the means to acquiring the same are gone? Now, do you really believe that? Is there a historical precedent for him ever doing that? That's ancient history, though. I mean, yeah, God does different today than they did then, yeah? Did he ever do that on American soil? He does. Some people live like that every day. Some Christian people live like that every day. But we're looking now for documented historical precedents. Yes, we can look back to the Old Testament. And we read of the wanderings of Israel for 40 years. How many New Balances did they wear out? How many?
None.
Those were some quality shoes in those days. Did you read of anything in the Scripture? Anything at all in the Scriptures that in their wandering that thousands just collapsed and fell by the wayside because they didn't get enough to eat or enough to drink? Anything like that? I mean, wasn't the number that entered the promised land greatly whittled down from what it had started out? Well, there was some whittling, but it wasn't due to starvation and dehydration. It was due to sin. So fast forward over the generations that will come. Thanksgiving, we always have little snippets of history, American history. And on American soil, was there any evidence of the providential provision of God upon those who first landed on the East Coast? He did. Was it an easy thing for them? They hit the shores. Got all their bags off the carousel and headed inland. And there what did they find? They found crops that were already in full bloom. There were butcher shops, haberdasheries all over the place. They just had to run up there, reach in their pockets, pull out their plastic and get whatever they wanted. Yes. So how did they get their grub? Yeah, they knew had a little bit about it, but they didn't get that way first, did they? Did any of those folks originally coming across fail to see the second winter? Mm-hmm. And so where does the promise of God then apply? If He is able to deliver us in our trials and afflictions or out of our trial and afflictions, what happened to those poor folks who didn't make it? Delivered, you'd say? Though all those who were redeemed by the grace of God surely did. Now, let me ask you this. If it comes down to that, if it comes right down to that, what Brent just said, are you able to deal with that in its imminence? Now that your hair's all mussed up and your shoes are all scuffed and your heart's flipping and flopping like mine, I would have you come to Hebrews 2 verse 18. And with that also, find your way to Acts 27. We're going to go on board another cruise just for a little bit here this morning. Staying focused, seek the frapping. Our God is as willing as He is able to deliver us. Hebrews 2 and verse 18. I would like to read this to you. And if you are so inclined to be blessed beyond the moment at hand, write some of these things down in the margin for your perusal over your morning cup of coffee on July 6th. Let me contextualize verse 17. Wherefore in all things it behooved him, our focal point, to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. For in that he, our focal point, he himself hath suffered being tempted, yet without sin, he is able to succor them that are tempted. He is able to bring aid. He is able to relieve. He is able to comfort. However, which way you want to bake that cake. Now, I point this out to you again, that you have in this word spelled S-U-C-C-O-R, botheia, comfort, relieve, give aid, help. You have that. That's in that word. He is able to do all that. Look over in chapter 4 and verse 16. Let me read that again to you as well. This great high priest we were talking about in chapter 2, we see, let us come, therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help, botheia. In time of need, can I ask this question? Now this is one of those questions that doctoral students in a prestigious theological seminary are often asked and are puzzled over the answer to the question. So if you find yourself puzzled over this, don't be alarmed. Okay? My question is this. We have grace to help where? Where does it say? No, that's when. Where? In the context, where? The throne of grace. Well, what do we do there? That is the seat of authority dominated by, occupied by, the only one who is able to keep that which you've committed unto him. Prayer is the means by which you and I are frapped. It is not the prayer in itself. Some people fancy themselves to be ardent prayer warriors and they misunderstand the energy for the act. Some people say, well, if you want to get something done, if you would like to see God work in your heart, go to such and such and such. They can really pray. Hold it, Newt. It's not the prayer, the prayer, it is the prayer. And the God who answers the prayer, who is able to keep you. He is the one who is able to frap you. And we'll get to that at Acts 27. If you would please come there. Acts 27. Staying focused, seek the frapping. I want to, first of all, begin with this premise that everybody in this chapter, on board this ship, 240 plus souls, were miserable. Just like those who pay big bucks go on an elaborate cruise and are out to sea for 2 or 3 days and find out that somebody got on board sick and spread it all around. And so you spend the balance of the cruise with an upset stomach or worse. Confined to quarters. Not going to the elaborate buffets, but now you're going to have to drink just the concoction to remedy your soul. Miserable. These folks were all miserable. Now, look at verse 17. In the storm, it says, when they had taken up, they used helps. They used helps. Bothia. Now what that word points to is that's the actual tool that they were going to use. The ropes or the cables. The next word, undergirding, describes the action or the activity of the sailors on board the vessel. The cables and the ropes were used to undergird the vessel. Now, why would they do that? Well, number one, the vessel's in jeopardy of coming apart in the storm. The undergirding. So it is said there in verse 17, when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksand, struck sail, and so were driven. Now let me come back to the front of the chapter. Staying focused, seek the frapping when you are miserable, even when your motions or your movements are not prudent. For example, verse 4 in chapter 27 says, when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And we sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, the city of Lycia, and there the centurion found the ship of Alexandria sailing into Elis. He put therein, and when we had sailed slowly many days and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete over against Salmon and hardly passing it. Hey, bottom line is this. The bottom line, my dear friends, they were in a storm due to the imprudent movements of someone beside themselves. The sailors had absolutely no say in their sailing. The decision was made by the ship's owner and the military authority. Everybody else on board with all the cargo and invested had nothing whatever in it at all. Nothing. So when you are miserable due to the motions of others, stay focused, seek the frapping. And also when you look at verse number 10, do so when you are in the minority. He said unto them, sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. So there you find that here is an instance where those with the voice of reason were in the minority. In the minority, providentially. Can I just put you on notice at this point? The Lord may just have a storm for you. For us. He may. Please notice also that in verse number 13, stay focused, seek the frapping, even when mistakes are obvious. When the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close by Crete. But what's the next two words? Not long. The storm comes. They made a mistake. First of all, they shouldn't have been sailing at the time they were sailing, but they went anyway. So now they're out there. They are en route. And some would interpret the soft winds blowing as a providential sign of God that His hand is upon our voyage. But not long after, the storm arose. And when you are in the minority due to the motions and mistakes of other people, stay focused. Stay focused. Seek the frapping. And then you find the misery is so profound when you look at verses 15 through 20. You can't get any other picture. The misery is profound. The ship was caught, could not bear into the wind. They had a lot of work. Verse 16, verse 18, and we being exceeding tossed with tempest. The next day they lightened the ship. The third day we cast out with our own hands and the tackling of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. The misery was profound. And here's where the bottom comes up. Mortality becomes reality. When you are put in a position, in the minority position, due to the motions and mistakes of other people, and you are cast into the midst of a horrible storm, understand that mortality becomes reality. It sets in, all hope taken away. What then should we do? Well, I was reading verse 21, and it occurs to me what it says there right at the top of the verse. It never caused pause before. They had lost their hope, but then it says, after a, what kind of abstinence? Long. Now, I wouldn't say to you that Paul was purposely letting them stew. I wouldn't say that. I would rather say that Paul did not say anything for a long time there, comparatively, because he had no word from God to say. But after a long absence, Paul stood forth in the midst of the men and said, "Sirs, you should have hearkened unto me." Now, verse 22, "I exhort you to be of good cheer." And then he makes some pretty definitive statements. "There shall be no loss of life. Forget about your mortality. Think now about swimming. No loss of life." Now the ship's going down, and his source is, verse 23, "There stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am, whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul. Thou must be brought before Caesar and to God, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me." Now there's the frapping right there. And now mortality is placed in proper perspective. The message is very pointed. The frapping is secured. There will not be any loss of life. The ship is going down. The cargo is lost. But just as much as God prepared the belly of a whale for Jonah, God providentially prepares a landing spot for people in a storm, as he did here in Acts 27. It may just be, now listen, if we are committed to let him determine the winds of adversity for us, as he did with Jonah and those sailors, then we need to be willing also to swim for it, if God have us do it. I do not know how many in the room do not know how to swim. I know how to swim like a fish. Like a fish, I can swim for about 2 or 3 feet. I can doggy paddle or tread water for a good while, but I drink a lot in the process. There may be some in the room who don't know how to swim. And how is it that you don't know how to swim? How is it that you don't know how? How would you know? Huh? Yeah, but I mean, how do you know that you can't swim unless you get in the water and try it? I mean, you take precautions. You know, some people want to maybe put a line on your waist and go in the water. And if you can't make it on the surface, somebody can drag you in from the bottom. Then try again. I mean, the body is amazing the way God constructed it. It is absolutely buoyant if you keep your mouth closed. It's absolutely buoyant. Can't sink. And in the midst of a trial or in the midst of a storm, God may bring us to the point where we have to swim for it. But we better be sure that our point or the source for our information is to be had at the throne of grace. Ever so sure that we beseech our great high priest in prayer, for there the frapping can be secured. There we can be undergirded. But we must stay focused, and it is Him, unto Him, that we seek for the frapping. Would you pray with me, please?